Well, it's Tuesday, August 16th here in Washington, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Michael Lippin. In the next half hour, Russia and Iran boost their cooperation in the fight against the Islamic State group in Syria. We'll ask why. We'll take you to the front lines of a Kurdish battle to oust the militants from Iraq's second biggest city. China launches a new satellite to try to protect itself from hackers back on Earth. And we'll have the latest from day 11 of the Olympics, including the story of two Ghanaian athletes who wouldn't be there without some help from America. It's all ahead on International Edition. The Russian Defense Ministry has announced its first use of an Iranian airbase to carry out airstrikes against Islamist militants in Syria. The long-range Russian bombers took off on Tuesday from an airbase near the Iranian city of Hamadan. Russian warplanes have been bombing militants opposed to Syrian President Bashar al-Assad since last September. Iran also is an ally of Assad. International Edition's Laurie London discussed Russia's move to use Iranian airbases with Mark Katz. He's a professor of government and political affairs at George Mason University, and she asked him how significant that move is.
It certainly shows that Russian-Iranian cooperation is looking more like an alliance. I'm not sure it's an outright alliance, but you know, considering how prickly the Iranians have been about any foreign military presence in their country, for them to allow the Russians to make use of one of their facilities really is quite remarkable. I think it also shows is that both the Russians and the Iranians are quite nervous about the strength of the opposition in Aleppo, and so they want to take care of this problem, and so they're showing resolve.
But then we hear that that Moscow and the U.S. are possibly working on some sort of a agreement to end the violence in Syria. That would seem contrary to Iran and Russia having an alliance to continue to have Bashar al-Assad in power.
Yes, well, I think that suggests that the Russians might not be terribly serious about these negotiations with the United States. That the I think the main goal for the Russians is to prevent further American involvement in terms of helping the opposition. And if negotiating a settlement does that, that's fine. But I think that what's very clear is that they're not so much interested in appealing to opposition forces. And I think the fact of the matter is that what the Russians understand is that the Obama administration does not want to get further involved in Syria. And if the way to do this is to be engaged in negotiations with the Russians are happy to play along. As the U.S. itself knows, is that simply air campaigns, bombing campaigns alone aren't going to defeat opposition forces.
So what exactly could lead to an end to this horrific conflict?
I'm not sure that we're going to see an end anytime soon, but I think that at some point there needs to be some kind of leadership change in Damascus. You know, but obviously Iran and Russia aren't working for that right now, and Assad isn't either. But it could come about through a faction within the Assad regime, or if the Iranians in particular, perhaps the Russians, decide that they're just tired of this guy, if they could get rid of him in some face-saving manner. In other words, that he wasn't somehow overthrown. But it's and of course, you know, he's not that old, but he is mortal. He can't last forever. But I think that as long as we have the current situation, I don't see the conflict ending. I don't see. I think that the trouble is that one has to be able to identify some segment of the opposition that would be willing to break with its fellows and to make a deal with the Assad regime to lay the basis of a new regime. And I just don't see that happening, nor do I see the, you know, sort of like a Chechen solution, which I imagine is what Moscow has in mind, that they just want to defeat all the opponents and establish some very harsh regime. But it's a lot harder in Syria than it is for them in Chechnya. And, of course, it's not so easy in Chechnya.
And that was Mark Katz of George Mason University in conversation with my colleague Laurie London. Well, switching gears now for our social media segment, International Edition's Jiabi Lee is here with the biggest trending stories online. Hi, G.
Hi, Michael. You have probably seen the photo of Jamaican sprinter Usain Bolt running way ahead of his rivals during the men's 100-meter dash. And who hasn't, right?
Yeah, he was far ahead there.
He was. And on social media, many users wanted to know just who took that unforgettable photo.
All right, well, end the suspense. Who is it?
It was Sydney-based photographer Cameron Spencer. The online verdict seems to be that he took one of the best photos of Bolt. He's a staff photographer with Getty Images and on Twitter at CJSPENCOIS. He captioned the iconic photo like this: "Always a great day at work when the world's fastest man pops in. Hashtag Getty Sport at Usain Bolt." More than 8,000 people liked that tweet, which is quite high for someone that people didn't really know very well until this Olympics.
So this photograph will probably get him a lot of attention, which is great.
Absolutely.
What else is trending online today?
A popular hashtag Tuesday afternoon is hashtag Justin Deactivated Party. And that, of course, refers to Justin Bieber, who is a very popular Canadian pop star.
Right.
The VOA news account tweeted, "Justin Bieber has gone nuclear in war with fans of Selena Gomez by deleting his Instagram." Gomez is his ex-girlfriend. Mm-hmm. They were going back and forth on the photo sharing app before he turned his account into private and ultimately deleting his account.
He deleted Instagram. How could he?
That's a very big move. And he used to be the sixth biggest Instagram user. And by deleting this account, he upset many of his followers. One of his fans tweeted this: "Justin is really forgetting who pays his bills. Watch me download his next album illegally." Big warning.
Right. Well, you may not like that. What else is trending today?
An Italian restaurant in New Mexico is in the hot seat for selling a line of merchandise that puts a culinary spin on Black Lives Matter movement.
Well, the Black Lives Matter, that's the movement that's protesting alleged police brutality here in the U.S.
That's right, and especially against certain demographic. And that line the restaurant is using is Black Olives Matter. And some people are saying that's insensitive, while other people are saying it's just a joke. And speaking of joke, it's hashtag National Tell-A-Joke Day.
My favorite day in the world. What, do you have a joke for us?
You bet. Here's one from Oxford Classics. What would you find in Charles Dickens' kitchen? The answer is the best of times, the worst of times. You wouldn't get this joke if you don't know herbs.
Yes, well, you wouldn't, but it's a good one. Thanks so much, G.
Thank you.
If you want to follow G on Twitter, she is at GIABBYLEE. I'm at Michael_Lippin, and the show is at VOA_IE. Well, here are some of the stories on voanews.com that are making headlines. U.S. says South Korea-based American missile defense system is no threat to China. UN condemns Saudi coalition bombing of Yemeni hospital. U.S. Homeland Security Department offers to help U.S. states with cybersecurity for voting machines. Austria police say no terror link in train stabbing. And U.S. Republican presidential candidate Trump says supporters of bigotry and hatred will not enter the U.S. if he's elected. Expanded coverage of these stories and more on voanews.com. This is International Edition. Kurdish Peshmerga forces are making progress in the battle to recapture the northern Iraqi city of Mosul from Islamic State militants, who have been occupying the city since June 2014. Ali Javanmardi of VOA's Persian service is accompanying the Peshmerga fighters and filed this report from the battle's front line southeast of Mosul with narration by Miguel Amaya.
There is no time for sleep as the fighters prepare in the darkness for the operation that will begin in a few hours. The objective is to reach into the heart of the so-called Islamic Caliphate. Driving to the front line along with troop commanders, American military advisors can be seen in the vicinity, but decline to talk about their role. Before the attack begins on the ground, U.S.-led coalition fighter jets bomb ISIS positions. Then, Peshmerga fighters go into the action. But the Peshmerga advance is slowed by militants, who take cover in homes where underground tunnels have been dug. Team A, an advancing Peshmerga unit, attacks militants in this house. The ISIS fighters fiercely defend their position and do not give up. We are stopped from getting any closer. The Peshmergas say they have not let any reporter accompany Team A before. So far, two Peshmerga fighters have been killed near where we are. Six have been wounded. The Peshmerga fighters appear to have enough weapons, unlike in the past. What they seem to need is more coordination in launching their assaults. Not heeding their commanders, some fighters act on their own, which perhaps explains the surge in casualties. Then tanks show up, ending the battle, leaving tens of ISIS militants dead. The houses where the militants dug tunnels are destroyed, so they are not used again. The village is purged of militants.
Fortunately, today we were able to free 10 villages in a 200 square kilometer area. Right here where we are standing, we're about 18 kilometers from Mosul.
This is what liberation looks like, a destroyed village. It is unclear when it will be rebuilt or when its inhabitants will return. For VOA's Ali Janmarmardi, southeast of Mosul, I'm Miguel Amaya, VOA News.
China has launched its first satellite into orbit using quantum technology to give it the ability to send Earth-based communications that they hope will be secure from hackers. The satellite was put into space on Monday aboard a Long March 2D rocket from a launch site in Gansu province in the northwestern Gobi Desert. The Xinhua news agency said that during its two-year mission, the satellite will establish hack-proof quantum communications by transmitting uncrackable keys from space to the ground. Morris Jones, an independent Australian space analyst who monitors the Chinese space program, told VOA's Victor Beatty that it's a major step forward for the Chinese.
And they are the first nation on Earth to actually do this with a military communications satellite. But all things considered, I don't think that the quantum communication system is as impregnable as the Chinese would have us believe.
Why would you say that?
Well, to be fair, the quantum part of the system truly is as good as they say it is, in the sense that if you try to intercept the signal, it disrupts, which makes the quantum part very difficult to hack. But let's not forget that the quantum link, the quantum communications link, is just one part of a communication system that isn't all entirely as secure as this new quantum component. And if history is any guide, every system has a weak point, and it's that weak point, when it's discovered, that will be used to hack it.
And will other countries attempt to do so?
I'm quite sure that they're already working on ways to do so, and they'll probably focus on intercepting ground terminals where the signal isn't in a quantum state that are more easily intercepted by conventional eavesdropping techniques.
Where does this put China's space program in comparison to that of, say, Russia or the U.S.?
Well, the whole thing is the Chinese have one of the top space programs in the world, and currently they're still very much on an upward trajectory. The Russians, by contrast, are stagnating and seem to be falling backwards. And as for America, well, if America doesn't regroup within the next 5 years, they will truly start to lose ground to the Chinese. So the Chinese know that they're gaining ground on America, and they're just waiting for a chance to surpass the American space program in the next decade and a half.
What else is China doing in the space program that makes it so prominent?
I think China is doing some excellent things with astronaut launches. Just in a few months' time, they're going to launch their second space laboratory. They're also getting ready to send robot spacecraft to the moon and onwards to Mars. They're also working on astronomy and astrophysics and scientific satellites. So China, in some ways, is covering every base in terms of spaceflight: rockets, satellites, space stations, astronauts, communication satellites, defense satellites. They've got the whole spread covered in terms of their technologies. And very few nations on Earth have been able to do that. I'd say only three global space programs have really achieved that clean sweep.
That was independent Australian space analyst Morris Jones speaking to International Edition's Victor Beatty. This is VOA.
I'm Victor Beatty. Since 1942, the Voice of America has been a consistently reliable and authoritative source of news. Today, VOA remains committed to providing an accurate, objective, and comprehensive news product at the top of every hour, every day. We can be heard on your local affiliate or streamed on the web at voanews.com.
This is VOA's International Edition with me, Michael Lippin. U.S. gymnast Simone Biles has won her fourth gold medal of the 2016 Olympic Games in Tuesday's floor exercise competition. Biles, who is 19, has given one of the best performances ever by a gymnast in the Olympics. Only four other women have won four golds in the single games. Men's gymnastics also headed into its final day on Tuesday with competition in the parallel and horizontal bar events. Well, staying with Rio, our correspondent at the Games, Park Brewer, caught up with members of the Ghanaian delegation in the past few days. And he learned that they have quite a strong connection to the United States. I spoke earlier on the phone to Brewer and asked him what was special about two of those Ghanaian athletes in particular.
Well, Michael, this is a very unique story. Both John Mpoma and Janet Mponsa, they have very similar last names. They're from Ghana, but they study and are coached in the United States. Both of them go to Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. Now, if you don't know where that is, it's a suburb of Nashville and actually one of the fastest-growing cities, or if not the fastest-growing city, in the state of Tennessee. It has about 100,000 population there. And what's remarkable about it is the head coach at this university, a man named Dean Hayes, has been there coaching for 50 years. That's a half a century. And one of the guys he brought in there, who is an assistant coach there, is named Andrew Owusu, and he's from Ghana. And Hayes actually in the mid-70s was one of the pioneers of recruiting athletes from Africa, bringing them to Middle Tennessee State on scholarship. And if you look at the roster today of the track and field team at Middle Tennessee State, you're going to see that more than half of the athletes on the teams, both men and women, are from Africa. You've got these two Ghanaians who I've talked about who are competing here at the Rio Olympics, but you also have athletes from Uganda, Nigeria, and Kenya. And I also understand that in the past there, they've also had athletes from South Africa as well as Senegal. So it's very interesting how this has all come about. And these two Ghanaians here at the Olympics, Janet herself ran in the 200 meters on Monday, kind of disappointed in her result, didn't do as well as she would have liked. However, she's got another chance because the Ghanaian 4x100-meter women's relay team will take to the track on Thursday. Now, John, on the other hand, he's 26. He just graduated from Middle Tennessee State University, and he'll be competing in the javelin Wednesday night. He, in fact, has broken the national record for the javelin in Ghana over the last 4 years, about five different times, which is quite remarkable. He's kind of a rising star in the sport, and his best result is a silver medal at the All-Africa Games last year. And he's trying to take his career to the next level, and he's hoping he can do that. And then once he retires from competition, he might like to go on and be a coach and help other Ghanaian athletes.
Well, Park, the two Ghanaian athletes that you met in Rio, what did they say about their experience of studying in Tennessee and how it helped them in their athletics pursuits?
Well, they both really enjoyed it very much. And one of the things that they said is the president of the Ghana Athletics Association is the guy that really was responsible for getting them their scholarships. They feel that it's very important if you're going to be an athlete that you can't just be an athlete. You've got to prepare for life beyond athletics. So that is a priority. They want him to study hard, and they want to graduate. And in fact, Andrew Owusu, the assistant coach, told me, he said, the one thing I do is maybe I check on them a little too much about their academics, but I want them to study hard, and I want them to graduate. And, this is key because, you're only going to be an athlete for so long, and you got to have something after that.
Right. Well, I'm sure he means well. But thanks so much to Park Brewer, our correspondent in Rio covering the games.
My pleasure, Michael.
Well, another of our correspondents in Rio, Jeff Swicord, has been taking in some of the city's beaches and nightlife. Here's his report about what Rio has to offer Olympic visitors besides the sports.
What is there to do in between sporting events in Rio de Janeiro? A lot. You are in one of the most exotic cities in the world. First, you can head out to world-famous Copacabana Beach for a stroll along the surf and the incredible view. Or kick a soccer ball around with friends. The more adventurous can jump into a pickup volleyball game on the sand. Hungry? You can always have lunch in one of the many cafes along the promenade and soak in some live entertainment. Of course, there is always shopping on the beach. The salesmen come to you. Vince Corten and his family are from Belgium. They were here during the World Cup 2 years ago and were so impressed they decided to come back for the Olympics.
Rio is a fantastic city. Of course, we have the Olympics, but you have fantastic bars, restaurants, music, meeting people, and for the time being, it's so international, so we love it.
At night is when Rio de Janeiro really comes alive. For the nightlife, you head to Lapa, the old Portuguese quarter of town, full of bars and music venues of all kinds. The 18th century aqueduct, one of the city's landmarks, was built to carry water from the Carioca River to Santa Teresa in the hills. Today, it is a cable car bridge. Tonight, the party spills out into the streets as fans watch a soccer match. Nick Brown is a Brazilian-American from Miami.
You know, everyone's just so happy and so cheerful and seeing people from all over the world, you know, like uniting and being friends and partying together and just, you know, exploring everything and, you know, everything.
After the match, a night on the town would not be complete.
That's it for International Edition. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you later.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
A living nightmare is how Deputy Secretary of State Antony Blinken described life for religious and ethnic minorities in Iraq and Syria under the barbarous, genocidal regime of Daesh. Speaking at a Washington conference on the threat posed to these communities, Mr. Blinken said there is grave concern over their very survival. He noted, however, that the global coalition's momentum against Daesh is growing and has led to a significant liberation of territory held by the terrorist group, a cut in their financing, a diminution of the flow of their foreign fighter recruits, and the elimination of thousands of their leaders. But more needs to be done. Iraqi forces, he said, are preparing for the greatest battle against Daesh to date, the liberation of the Iraqi city of Mosul and the surrounding Nineveh plains. Deputy Secretary Blinken stressed that the twin responsibilities of military victory and inclusive political and economic progress must proceed together in lockstep. Mr. Blinken noted that Mosul holds a unique place in Iraqi history and identity. For thousands of years, Christians, Yazidis, Turkmen, Sunni, Shabak, Kurds, Shia, all have made this ancient city their home. He called the area the cradle of civilization, rich in ancient cultural artifacts, but most importantly, representative of Iraq's cultural infrastructure of pluralism and diversity. He emphasized the importance of the Iraqi government's providing a fundamental accommodation in which all of Iraq's communities believe they have a future in Iraq.
All Iraqis, be they Sunni, Shia, Kurd, Christian, or any other, have to be convinced that the state that they've been asked to fight for, the state they've been asked to remain a part of, will stand up for their rights and their equities, that they can advance their interests more effectively as citizens of a united Iraq than as supplicants of other regional powers or members of isolated competitive blocs in a fractured and weakened state.
Deputy Secretary Blinken observed that the real wealth of a nation is defined not by its size or military prowess, but by its human resources. Countries that invest in the health, in the prosperity, in the security, in the diversities of their societies will thrive in the 21st century. That is the future. And with international assistance, it is the future, Deputy Secretary Blinken said, that the Iraqis can make possible for their communities and for their country.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.